The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's no law enforcement authority in virtually any Homeland Security sub-agency that extends to state law. And so, you know, what I think is the move here that is both ominous and I think unjustified is the move to treat both relatively minor federal crimes and perhaps even some state offenses as the kinds of threats to Homeland Security that all of these statutory authorities then trigger various responses to, in a context in which, you know, there's no suggestion outside of maybe right-wing media that local authorities are unwilling or unable to enforce the relevant federal statutes.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 21st, 2020. Yesterday, Lawfare published an article revealing and analyzing a document from the Department of Homeland Security offering legal guidance to analysts in its Office of Intelligence and Analysis regarding the appropriate intelligence activities to mitigate the threat to monuments, memorials, and statues, among other things. To discuss this new information and its implications, we assembled in the Virtual Jungle Studio not only the two authors of that article, Lawfare's editor-in-chief Benjamin Wittes and University of Texas law professor Steve Vladek, but also Kerry Cordero, senior fellow and general counsel at the Center for New American Security, who has researched and written extensively on DHS authorities and policies, and Paul Rosenzweig, senior fellow for national security and cybersecurity at the R Street Institute, and himself a former deputy assistant secretary for policy at DHS. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 21st, the expanded intelligence activities of the Department of Homeland Security. Ben, start us off. Today, Lawfare posted an article, DHS authorizes domestic surveillance to protect statues and monuments. What is this all about? What information came forward and what does it indicate?
Well, yesterday evening, I received a copy of a guidance document, which was sent to the DHS Office of Intelligence Analysis, which purports to give legal guidance regarding collection, retention, and distribution of intelligence in connection with the protests that are going on. The specific context appears to be Portland, although it is not 100% clear from the document that that's what generated it. The document describes the president's executive order of a month ago, late June, which we had kind of all thought was a nothing burger at the time, designating the protection of monuments and statues, as well as federal property and buildings, as a significant homeland security issue, and therefore concluded that it was appropriate for INA, the Intelligence and Analysis Group at DHS, to do domestic collection and intelligence concerning people and organizations that posed a significant threat either to federal personnel, to federal buildings or activities, but also to monuments and statues, public memorial statues, whether they are federal or not. And so the question that this raised to me was, hey, I knew that DHS had a sort of analytic cadre that did kind of terrorism and, other sort of homeland security threats. But since when did statues and monuments become a homeland security threat of the sort of magnitude that would justify essentially spying on protesters?
Right. And to be fair, it's important to note what the document did not say. It had some retention guidelines, if I recall, requiring that U.S. person information that was not mission related must be purged within 180 days. And it said something about the surveillance had to be for the sole purpose of monitoring activities, could not be related to First Amendment exercises or the purpose of suppressing criticism. Is that right?
Yeah. So these are basically the Attorney General's guidelines for DHS intelligence activities. And those are kind of standard components of them. And they do apply to this as well. And this document sort of reemphasizes that, it would not be appropriate under this document to say, well, hey, David Priest is protesting, next to the, Nathan Bedford Forrest Memorial. Therefore, let's check out all his social media posts. But it would be appropriate, for example, if you were involved in such a protest and you, for some reason, they had a good faith basis for believing that you posed a threat to that monument, to say, check out all your social media posts, public social media posts, and presumably who you were following, who was part of the group that you were putting together for this protest. And so you end up spying on a lot of people who, even if there was a reasonable basis to fear that you might do something to this statue, there would be, all the people around you might be implicated in this collection in a fashion that really poses, I think, some First Amendment concerns.
Let's dig a little bit deeper on this then. Steve, at its core then, assuming that there is some actual defacing of a monument, a memorial, or a statue, is what this memo inside DHS talks about, is it legal, and how so?
So, I mean, I think the short answer is yes, it is probably legal in the sense that, the Office of Intelligence and Analysis is not, it's not the NSA. They're not directly intercepting communications. They are not conducting the kinds of surveillance that raise Fourth Amendment concerns, where we might have to talk about, who has an expectation of privacy and the like. I think the place where it really starts looking sketchy to me, and where one argument might be that it exceeds the statutory mission of the Department of Homeland Security, is insofar as the monuments and memorials that are being defaced are not federal and are not on federal property. I mean, there are ways to read the memo so that the defacement of any public memorial would qualify within the relevant hook. And, no one's going to dispute that defacing a memorial is a crime, whether it's a federal memorial or a state or local memorial. But the notion that the Department of Homeland Security has jurisdiction in a case in which it's purely state or local property, and even if it has jurisdiction, the notion that it ought to be a Homeland Security priority within the auspices of the Homeland Security Act, that's where I think there's there are certainly arguments that this is not a naked violation of the statute, but, this is not what the Department of Homeland Security was created to do. And, separate from the sort of more galling optical concerns I have, it's part and parcel of what strikes me about the entire Portland phenomenon, which is the executive branch of the federal government using some isolated acts of vandalism of federal property and one assault on a U.S. Marshals Service deputy as justification for effectively this massive federal response that now, as we've learned from this memo, includes intelligence gathering on, you know, I mean, for better or for worse, peaceful protesters who just happen to be in the neighborhood with other people who might be vandals. And so, you know, the short answer is it probably just skirts the line of being legal. I mean, I don't think this, you know, government just willy-nilly does things that are illegal, but it just seems like a just terrible abuse in optical and normative terms of why we have a Department of Homeland Security and why we have an Office of Intelligence Analysis within it.
So fair to you to say that it may not be illegal, that is, there may be legal reasoning behind it, but that doesn't make it good policy.
Lawful but awful, if you will. Yep. Right. But I think, I mean, to stress the awful part of it, I mean, you know, as we say in the piece, and this is something that I think the original, that we clarified it after we wrote it initially, you know, because this is not counterintelligence operations on the part of Homeland Security, they're only collecting public source information. That is to say, they're only, you know, getting information that's already available out there in the world, which is a big part of why I suspect it's not unlawful. But, you know, there are reasons why we don't just let the government do that for any reason at any time. And, you know, I have very little faith that the government's in a position to meaningfully separate out the very small number of people who actually are committing federal crimes in the middle of these protests from the hundreds of folks who may at most be committing local and state crimes, and the thousands of folks who are doing nothing illegal, indeed, who are exercising the quintessential First Amendment right of protesting their government. That's where this memo, like so much of the federal government's response in Portland, makes me enormously queasy.
Yeah, by coincidence, it seems, Kerry, today in the Bulwark, you wrote that the Department of Homeland Security is becoming almost a rogue arm of federal law enforcement due to a combination of what you call inherent insufficiency within its own internal controls and inappropriate political pressure. Talk through that a bit. And how do you see this new guidance as a manifestation of that?
Sure. Well, the piece in the Bulwark also talks about how I think that DHS is basically going down the road of becoming an accidental internal security service, or at least that the potential, the groundwork is sort of there for them to do it if they wanted to. And within, I think, 12 hours of that piece going up, Ben and Steve have written this Lawfare piece that in some ways confirms that that's the path that the department has been going down. So my concerns with respect to the oversight and accountability of the department stem from the fact that I don't think Congress intended to make the Department of Homeland Security the nation's largest law enforcement force. And yet that is actually what has happened. I think if you asked most members of the public, or even most members of Congress, perhaps, you know, who's the chief law enforcement officer of the country? I think they probably would tell you the attorney general. Maybe some would think of the FBI director in that role, but I don't think they would tell you it was Chad Wolf. And yet the acting secretary now commands an over 60,000 person strong law enforcement component of the federal government. And when you couple that with the president's political aspirations and political narrative, where he wants to present himself as a, quote, law and order president, and the political malleability that we're seeing amongst the leadership at DHS, where now he has fired or removed nearly every original Senate-confirmed official who has served in that department, it just makes for a toxic brew of a large law enforcement force that has a variety and broad array of legal authorities to perform their particular mission. And now those authorities are being manipulated by weak leaders who are influenced politically. And it's a very bad combination.
Paul, let me get your take on this, because you among us have actually served in the Department of Homeland Security in a policy role, but that probably makes you more aware than any of us about the application of the Homeland Security Act of 2002 to the day-to-day duties of the department. And that act was very clear. The primary mission of the department was listed as preventing terrorist attacks within the United States, reducing the vulnerability of the United States to terrorism, to minimizing damage from terrorist attacks. That sure doesn't sound like what this guidance is offering. How do you think this jibes with the statutory creation of Homeland Security and how it has evolved to this point?
Well, I think Steve got it exactly right. It's lawful but awful, which is to say that the department was created with a lot of discretionary authorities that made sense at the time and make sense even today if they're deployed in the face of true emergencies that require exigent responses by the executive branch, say to a terrorist threat or attack of some sort. What is unique about what the department is doing now and what the Trump administration is doing now is deploying those same discretionary authorities in the service of essentially the president's political agenda and in the service of an aggrandizement to the department of authority over domestic issues that nobody would have anticipated it would have at the time of its founding. Kerry is exactly right that one of the factors that's allowing this to happen is the absolute dearth of leadership at the department. Everybody's in an acting capacity of one form or another in ways that transgress the spirit, if not the letter, of the Vacancies Reform Act. And Steve can talk to you about that at length, I'm sure. But all of these authorities make some sense. I mean, initially, you like the idea that the Federal Protective Service can be supplemented with other personnel if necessary in an emergency. What's wrong here is that it's a fake emergency. The only thing that any of my colleagues have said so far that I would sort of disagree with a little bit is, and it actually makes the point even stronger, is Steve's cautionary note that this involves the protection of non-federal monuments and icons. And sadly, that's true of a lot of DHS authority. Most of the critical infrastructure that the department is assigned responsibility for in one way or another is non-federal in nature. And sometimes it exercises that protective authority in a regulatory way. Sometimes it exercises it in a physical way. One of my, you know, favorite stories from the beginning was our decision that I think was mistaken at the time and has since been rescinded to include the Iowa State County Fair as critical infrastructure because of the potential for catastrophic terrorist attack.
Was it an election year? Because it might be.
Well, I mean, I think it was, but it was state owned is the point. And yet it was listed in the DHS list of early protected icons and monuments and events. Mm-hmm. Because of its potential for negative terrorist consequence. So that one piece of what Steve said, I don't think actually forms a good breakpoint, at least not in terms of the way the department is historically operated. I think what is more manifest about that, and I'll end with this, is that most of those, all of those, were offered by states as things that we wanted, that they wanted DHS assistance
right.
for. So
right.
what's really unique about this circumstance, of course, is that at least in Portland, the governor and the mayor are saying to DHS, get out. And DHS is saying, no, we're here anyway, which is truly a bizarre application of the state-federal partnership idea that undergirded DHS.
Sure. Let me get a response to that. Kerry, what do you think?
So I do want to just point out, and I'm curious as to Paul and Steve and Ben's reaction to this, that I do think there is an argument, however, that the activity, at least as it was described in their piece, I haven't seen the complete original memo. So I'm just going based off of what they have reported. I do think there's an argument that the activity described does go beyond the statutory authorization, the statutory mandate for the intelligence analysis unit, which is supposed to do, because it's in the title, analysis. And the way that that's described in the Homeland Security Act is that it would do analysis of information obtained by other components. So it's other components within the department itself and information obtained from other governmental entities. So the way I understand INA to have been designed is that it was the repository where information collected from other components within the department. So, for example, information that ICE might come across in the conduct of conducting immigration enforcement, or information that state and locals might obtain in the context of doing their law enforcement activities, or information obtained from the intelligence community that then needs to be pushed out to law enforcement and state and locals, that INA was supposed to do that analysis. I do think that this is a big jump and potentially outside the scope of their statutory responsibilities to have analysts be authorized to do collection.
Steve, what do you think about this?
I mean, I think Carrie is certainly right that it's a big jump, especially from what the practice has been for the first, you know, decade and a half, a little more of the department. I was looking at the relevant statute, which is 6 USC section 121D. And, you know, there's discussion in the statute about other threats, right? So much of the focus, as understandably, is on terrorism and vulnerabilities arising from potential terrorist attacks, et cetera. But there are these vague references to other threats to the homeland. And I think, you know, where I sort of think all the rubber is hitting the road, both in Portland and I think shortly in Chicago, is this notion that any offense against federal law can be a threat to the homeland, right? And mm-hmm. that, so to sort of tie this back to Paul's one quibble with me, which I thought was perfectly fair, you know, it's always been true that Homeland Security has plenty of interests and oversight and responsibility for stuff that isn't just federal and federal property. The one exception I would say, though, is there's no law enforcement authority in virtually any Homeland Security sub-agency that mm-hmm. extends to state law. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what I think is the move here that is both ominous and I think unjustified is the move to treat both relatively minor federal crimes and perhaps even some state offenses as the kinds of threats to Homeland Security that all of these statutory authorities then trigger various responses to, in a context in which, you know, there's no suggestion outside of maybe right-wing media that local authorities are unwilling or unable to enforce the relevant federal statutes.
Right. I want to get responses from Paul and Ben to that, but let me put this question out there to help frame those responses. At one level, the kind of activity that's being described here as triggering this INA action is just minor property crime, after all, and that doesn't seem to constitute a threat to the security of the homeland. On the other hand, any relatively minor crime against the person of the president would be considered a threat to the security of the homeland. So there's some difference between the person of the president and a Confederate statue. And where that lies is at the heart of this interpretation of lawful but awful. So first, Paul, respond to that and to Steve, and then we'll turn to Ben.
Well, I guess the way I would characterize this is one of discretionary judgment. The statute is written broadly, especially given that it was crafted at a time of national crisis, in which it was thought that a large fraction of what had caused 9/11 was the rigidity of bureaucratic processes. And there's obviously some historical debate about that, but that was kind of what was animating this. And so to a large degree, the statute recapitulated something that's very common in all of our national security laws, which is strong congressional authorizations and limits with executive exceptions. And what we're seeing now is the weakness of that overall structure. Right. We rely on judgment to distinguish between minor threats to the person of the president and minor threats to a statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest. And yet the statute written as such probably can't capture that distinction. Mm-hmm. And so it authorizes responses in both places. I would add one other thing, and this is actually a bit of a response to Carrie, which is I actually strongly suspect, notwithstanding what the memo may say or what Ben says the memo says, because I haven't seen it, that the INA analysts are not actually doing the collecting. They don't have the drones. They don't have the access to the cameras. They may be trolling open source like Facebook and Twitter for leads on future protests. And in that sense, they might be conducting collecting, but they would have told you that that was analysis even beforehand. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I suspect most of the what's new about this is an integration of existing collection activity by ICE and CBP and Border Patrol into their analysis and a different targeting to a different collection requirement. Now they're going to collect about threats to statues instead of about threats to the president. And sure. So that discretionary change is really the more fundamental problem.
Ben.
Yeah, so I can shed a little bit of light on this question that Carrie and Paul both allude to, which is what the memo says, and is it really describing collection by INA? And the answer is yes, it really is describing collection by INA. But Paul's point is well taken, that it may not actually mean that. It may actually mean something more akin to what Paul is describing. That is, INA people doing a certain amount of social media collection in that sense, and sort of looking right. at open source stuff that's available online, but actual other collection coming from the components. That said, the memo is titled DHS Office of Intelligence Analysis Activities in Furtherance of Protecting American Monuments, etc. And it is written in the second person, you can do this. And so it's written actually to the Office of Intelligence and Analysis. The section on reasonable belief says, is your reasonable belief. You must have a reasonable belief that to do any intelligence activity addressed in this job aid, that it supports a mission. It's all written in the second person. Then when it gets to the section entitled Executing These Missions, it says you may collect, retain, and disseminate information as follows. And so the entire thing is written to you, i.e. the Office of Intelligence and Analysis, and there is an explicit discussion of collection and when you are allowed to collect. That said, I think Paul is probably right that what this actually is contemplating is a whole bunch of analysts doing the sort of network tracing. You know, to go back to my original example, we know that David Priest wants to do damage to that Nathan Bedford Forrest statue. So, you know, let's look at all his Facebook posts and maybe see who his friends are on Facebook and who's clicking that they like those. You know, let's blow up or not blow up, because that would be terrorism. Let's paint a, you know, horns on Nathan Bedford Forrest, right? And so I think it is possible to read the memo in a number of different ways in that regard. And I think probably for reasons that Steve and I can explain in more detail, we're almost certainly talking more about public record collation and annotation and collection here and social media trawling. And we're probably not talking about a lot of physical surveillance. Mm-hmm. And so my guess is we're talking about the reason it's written that this way is because it is contemplating a bunch of analysts sitting around kind of chasing down social media stuff.
Right. It would take a very ambitious analyst indeed to read that authorization for collection and say to herself, okay, that allows me to set up a covert network of sources to infiltrate organizations on my own. It does read more like using the, quote, collection that you do in the course of your duties against terrorist targets, for example. You can now do that against people who, I will say to all of you, does not include me at this point, who are defacing the Nathan Bedford Forrest statues.
Not yet, anyway.
Well, you don't rule anything out, Ben. Steve, let me turn to you to follow up on that specifically, which is the memo talking about the sole purpose of this collection and pointing out that in some detail about the analyst's need to establish reasonable belief to support this activity, that they can't rely on hunches or intuitions, which are insufficient, but must be based on experience, training, knowledge, facts, and circumstances, which you can articulate. Talk through that. Why was that necessary for whomever had the sad duty of writing this thing? Why did they have to put that in there to tell analysts, don't rely on hunches to create a reasonable belief?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds a heck of a lot like the jurisprudence regarding reasonable suspicion under the Fourth Amendment. And what, you know, I think law students could tell you chapter and verse is the doctrine of Terry stops. So the case law is replete with discussions of how government officers and especially law enforcement officers formulate reasonable suspicion. In theory, how they do it at the time they're actually acting on it, but in practice, it's usually how they do it after the fact when they have to explain themselves in court. And, you know, that case law says quite aggressively, hunches don't count, right? It has to be based on experience. It has to be based on, you know, it can be circumstantial evidence, but it has to be evidence. And so I think the idea here is that the, you know, whatever kind of collation and collection the INA analysts are doing, for it to be actionable in the sense that it's going to produce a report that is distributed to somebody else, you know, the memo is basically incorporating at least something akin to a Terry stop standard for the idea that before we're going to be, you know, putting together this file on an American citizen, we have to have a reasonable suspicion that they were doing more than just exercising their First Amendment rights. We have to have reasonable suspicion that they were somehow related to the ongoing or prior acts of criminality that we're investigating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that then just, I think, raises the question, well, what makes reasonable suspicion that one of hundreds of protesters in a crowd who perhaps on social media has video of, you know, an episode of vandalism, is him or herself somehow responsible for the vandalism? I mean, I think the, you know, the reasonable suspicion standard is notoriously malleable. Mm-hmm. And so I think the concern in this context is that, you know, it's very easy to impose reasonable suspicion by association in a context where you have clear acts of vandalism, perhaps even some federal crimes, and a heck of a lot of people who are, you know, in the neighborhood at in the wrong place at the wrong time. I think that's where all of this leads.
Yeah. The president by now has fired or has removed or has pressed to resign nearly every Senate-confirmed leadership official in the Department of Homeland Security, such that the organization now looks quite different from most other executive departments. Carrie, you've argued recently in your report for the Center of Numeric and Security that the Department of Homeland Security urgently requires congressional attention to improve its internal controls and its accountability mechanisms. And yet, so far today, we have not heard howls of rage from Congress about this activity from DHS, which implies that for some reason, this is not yet the tipping point to call for better congressional oversight of DHS, which, to be frank, is not just a function of the last 3 years, but has been out there for some 15 years. What do you think Congress can and should do to respond to this potential misuse of DHS authority?
Thanks. Yeah. Well, so first of all, just a word on that report, which actually Paul Rosenzweig also sat on the task force that helped give advice that went into that report, which was issued in May. And the report really focused on ways that Congress can increase the oversight and accountability of the department, focused in particular on the border security, immigration enforcement, and law enforcement components of the department. So I did a deep dive into the oversight that is very weak within the department. And one of the things that came out of that was, number one, the need for new guidelines, modernized investigative guidelines that would apply for all of the law enforcement related activity that the department does. And two, that the mission needed to be updated so that it would be of the department, so that it would reflect its actual activities as opposed to the terrorism focus that it was originally created for. And yet we all know that its day-to-day activities are very much out of sync with that. I do see members of Congress, in particular, the senators out of Oregon, concerned and expressing concern publicly about what has transpired in Portland. What I have been a little bit nervous about today is that they will take that concern that they have with what they're seeing in Portland and create legislative fixes that are very, very narrow, very, very tailored. So, for example, I've seen proposals to require that the DHS officers display their names or at least identify themselves, because there's been so many reports of federal government officials who are not identified in any meaningful way. And I guess I would say that's important and that's useful, but that doesn't even scratch the surface of what really needs to be done in the department. They need to take a much broader view at the fact that there is no component in the department that effectively coordinates internal oversight and control. That's why we ended up, I think, with officers in military-style fatigues deployed who are, at least according to the reporting I've seen, most likely originating from the Border Patrol or Customs and Border Protection, deployed into the interior of a United States city, engaged in activities that have nothing to do with the mission of their originating agency, and then engaging in those activities in a way that is potentially violative of constitutional rights. For example, the reports of people being detained without probable cause and then being released, which is something that, you know, we all in the national security space have heard of in other countries in other parts of the world that do not have the United States Constitution. So it's very concerning to see something like that here. So all of which is to say that I do hope that members of Congress seize this moment and understand that there really might be an opportunity here to take a really hard look at DHS and make much broader legislative adjustments that are far overdue, instead of just a couple things that might sound good, but really don't solve problems. And just one other final thought on that. I think there could be a perspective that, well, look, you know, Carrie, we're in the middle of a pandemic. We have all of these other, you know, which is a national health and economic and civic crisis. And, you know, it would be nice to reform DHS, but this really isn't the time. And, you know, to that, I would say it's time in times of crisis that adherence to the rule of law and having procedures and rules that law enforcement follows are actually most important. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that we are in a crisis where the country is just exhausted and overwhelmed by the coronavirus. And this happens to be the time that the Trump administration and the Department of Homeland Security are taking advantage of and saying that they're going to start deploying Homeland Security officials to numerous American cities.
Right. Before I circle back to Steve and Ben, Paul, Carrie just name dropped you there. So let me let you follow up on the congressional angle and we'll wrap that up. You've talked not just in contributing to that report, but for more than 10 years, you've been writing about the fact that well more than 100 different subcommittees in Congress have some portion of jurisdiction over DHS. So what can and should Congress do now?
Well, I think the problem that we face here is really a lack of congressional will, if you will. You know, Congress has known for 15 years that it needs to rationalize its oversight, and it will never do so because that means that they are engaged in some form of zero-sum game with some people gaining and some people losing. And so the mechanics of what they need to do, you know, reforming the oversight process and giving more authority to the Homeland Security committees is trivially easy. Really, the challenge, frankly, is getting somebody to care enough to do it. It is beyond my comprehension that Congress has yet to undertake this seriously. But even if they did reorganize it, that wouldn't be enough. They'd have to want to use that authority.
Right.
They'd have to want to exercise oversight over the department in a way
that effectively manages its activities. The department has not had an authorization bill since it was formed. The Department of Defense gets an authorization bill every year. So I don't want one every year, but let's give DHS one every 3 years just
to decade would be an
level set and guide it, right?
Yeah. Steve, let me turn to you both to respond to that. And then I have a question for you about the courts. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have two just sort of quick thoughts in response to Carrie and Paul. First, I mean, on the vacancy point, it's worth stressing, in case you lost track of your scorecard, today is the 468th day that there has not been a Senate-confirmed secretary of the Department of Homeland Security or even a nominee. That is the longest vacancy in a cabinet position in the history of this country. And I am floored every day that this has not become a huge, you know, sort of rallying cry for institutional-minded Republicans in the Senate, that their institutional authority is basically being completely eroded in the name of politics. And, you know, I don't think it is remotely a stretch to suggest, as Carrie has both, you know, here and elsewhere, that DHS is especially prone to much of this mishigas because these are all acting officials. And, you know, the triumvirate of acting Secretary Wolf, Ken Cuccinelli, who keeps unlawfully referring to himself as the acting deputy secretary when he isn't, and Mark Morgan, who's the acting CBP commissioner. You know, I think that's a big part of how we got here. On Congress, I think it's worth stressing that the administration may have actually timed this very poorly, because although DHS doesn't do authorization bills, they do appropriations bills. And DHS appropriations is on the House agenda for next week. And so, you know, I'm going to be very interested to see I don't think we should be surprised at all if Democrats rally around at least some kind of funding cutoff for some of what DHS is doing in Portland. Sure. I think the real question is whether that puts, you know, Republicans in the Senate into any kind of a pretty pickle, or whether, I mean, you know, I think I've only seen one Republican, Rand Paul, come out and criticize what's been going on in Portland. So I guess, you know, time will tell if that's going to go anywhere. But the one power Congress still has is the power to not appropriate funds for departments. And DHS, I think, is one where the Democrats may actually have, for the moment, a little bit of a stick.
And on the issue of acting officials, I have to mention that Acting Secretary Chad Wolf has just said on Fox News something that I think it's imaginable that a confirmed secretary would say, but it's a stretch. He said, "I don't need invitations by the state, mayors, or governors to do our job. We're going to do that whether they like us there or not." Ben, chime in here.
Well, you know, that is the kind of thing that is appropriate to say if it is the Eisenhower administration and the state officials are trying to prevent the integration of a university or a public school. But it is in an environment in which what you're referring to when you describe yourself as doing your job is, you know, patrolling the streets of a city in a fashion that the local community finds quite offensive, and in defense of principles that are, you know, the federal interest in downtown Portland is not the strongest federal interest in the world. I mean, I would never say that protecting a federal court is not an important equity, but it's not an equity that you need to effectuate in a fashion quite like that. And it's perfectly doable by other means. And so, you know, you have to ask the question, why are they doing this? And in that regard, I do think it's important to come back to Steve's original point, which is, you know, they're doing this because the president is interested in projecting a particular image, and it's the same image he tries to project about the border, right? He is the guy who is going to protect you from caravans. He is the guy who's going to protect you from anarchists in your cities. And you know, there's a significant racial element to this way of talking. And I do think that, you know, the deployment of the Department of Homeland Security for this purpose is a grotesque politicization of law enforcement. And it's one that is going to require a lot of restoration of confidence. And that kind of brings me back to Carrie's point, which I really want to foot stomp. The answer to this problem is not a law that requires, that people have names on their badges, although they should have their names displayed and they should identify their agencies. The answer to this problem is not a narrow set of reforms that, bans the specific practices that people are finding offensive. The answer to this problem is to ask in a deep way, why is the Department of Homeland Security amenable to this kind of politicization in a way that, for example, the FBI or the Secret Service have not been, right? And you don't see the Secret Service out there doing this, and you don't see the domestic components of the FBI counterintelligence people being deployed on matters like this. And you say, so what's functioning in those entities, which have had their own problems, to be sure, but they're functioning at a level that things in DHS are not. And because DHS is so big, I mean, CBP is the biggest law enforcement agency in the country by a lot. And, the possibility that it becomes the shock troops of the president's agenda, whatever president and whatever agenda, is not a healthy thing for a democratic culture.
Carrie and Paul, let me turn to both of you to follow up on this with some specific angles. Carrie, you've done a lot of looking not just at DHS, but also others operating in this wider area, and that's the National Counterterrorism Center, NCTC, or the analysts at FBI, even perhaps CIA in cooperation with them. Do you get the sense that this guidance that happened to go to the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Intelligence and Analysis, INA, do you think there might be parallel things going on at places like NCTC? And if so, is this the tip of the iceberg?
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen anything like that reported. I'm inclined to think not, because it doesn't sound like, and again, I'm relying on the write-up of this memo, but it doesn't sound like there's any foreign angle that is being alleged. And as you know, David, the intelligence community is focused on collecting foreign intelligence. So with respect to the CIA, with respect to most of what NCTC does, they would all be looking for a foreign intelligence angle. Now, whether or not the FBI in its domestic terrorism remit is looking at this, I think gets to an important question, because we have now heard over the last couple months since the protests have begun following the May killing of George Floyd, we have heard the Attorney General talk about anarchists and Antifa, and well, we've heard multiple Homeland Security officials talk about anarchists, and we've heard the president talk about anarchists. Yep. And what's unclear is whether there actually is any U.S. government intelligence analysis that indicates that there is some organized effort. In other words, whether they're domestic or not, they could be domestic, but organized domestic groups that are plotting violent activity. I feel like, particularly out of Homeland Security and out of the White House, that we're hearing things that sound like that, but I haven't actually seen anything that confirms it. And so I'm disinclined to believe it, not, in small part because of the lack of truth-telling record that the president has. So one of the major concerns that I have about this memo that Ben and Steve have reported is that it raises a question of, is the president setting intelligence collection priorities? And that's a job normally that we would think of would be the Director of National Intelligence, who sets intelligence collection priorities for the agency, for the intelligence community writ large, and for intelligence collection components. And that's based on a studied, objective review of the threat picture. Mm-hmm. And we have neither been the benefit of a worldwide threat briefing this year for the first time in, I think, 25 years. There was no annual worldwide threat briefing. And so we really have this big gaping question as to whether or not there is any truth at all to the administration talking points that these protests have components of them that are some kind of organized anarchist agenda. I'm not yet convinced. It might be that that information is there, although I think if it was there, they probably would communicate it to back themselves up, but I'm not hearing it.
Yeah. Paul, let me ask you to follow up on that, but also do include your perspective as a former policy official at DHS. I know the culture of CIA and to a lesser extent, the State Department and FBI from spending a lot of time in those places. I don't know the culture of the Department of Homeland Security. Is there a culture of the analysts in INA simply standing up, saluting, saying, yep, if you tell us that we're going to deploy all of our authorities and all of our assessments to the issue of peaceful protesters, damn it, we're going to do it because we do what we're told. Talk through a little bit of that culture in your answer before we close out with Steve.
Well, I think that there's an unstated and incorrect premise in your question, which is that DHS has a culture. each of the components has a historical culture.
Fair enough.
Most of them were seriously transformed by the events of 9/11. If you'd have asked what Customs and Border Protection's culture was before 9/11, the Border Patrol guys would have been basically cowboys on the border, and the customs guys would have been much more, you know, clerks, if you will, managing trade with a little bit of work with respect to immigration, but not that much. And INA didn't exist 15 years ago, so it has no culture at all. There's a reason that, as Ben accurately says, we haven't seen this sort of collapse at the FBI or even at the Secret Service, and that's because they are traditional storied agencies. They've made mistakes, Lord knows, in the past, and they've tried to learn from them, but they have an inculcated view of what their role is in this world. And even the oldest agencies at DHS, like CBP, had that inculcated view radically transformed, you know, just 15 years ago, and they're still trying to figure out what it is. The only agency at DHS that has retained, in my view, its real sense of self is the Coast Guard, which essentially has continued on as it had before without too much change in any of its focus or activities. So it is actually the lack of culture and, frankly, the lack of any ability at the senior management level to create such a culture. The secretary and centralizing forces lack any ability to bind the department together in a way that could create such a culture. And so they've lacked that leadership in terms of capabilities ever since the formations. To what extent they had successes, it was through force of will of strong secretaries like Chertoff and Jay Johnson. And that's what is lacking now is, you know, as Chad Wolf's quote makes clear, he's about as weak and subservient a man as you can imagine in this position.
So as a corollary of that, Paul, you don't see a strong sense of culture, especially in INA, prompting resignations over something like this?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. If there's any resignations in principle over this at DHS, I will eat my shorts. It's certainly at the political level. I imagine there may be some analysts, because a lot of the cadre at INA is ex-CIA or ex-FBI, so they have a sense that this shouldn't be happening. And there may be some at the GS 11 or 12 level, but otherwise, no.
Steve, let me close with you. We've talked about the executive and legislative branches, but Is there any judiciary action possible in the near term on this? That is, does an individual protester, even based on the revelation of this, have any standing to sue based on the presumption of harm of this kind of collection for First Amendment activity?
Probably not. I mean, there's a case from the 1970s that I think is not familiar to many folks called Laird versus Tatum. And Laird versus Tatum was actually a lawsuit arising out of allegations that turned out to be pretty true about wide-scale government surveillance of domestic protests during the Vietnam War. And the Supreme Court in Laird versus Tatum threw the case out because it held that the plaintiffs didn't have standing because they couldn't actually demonstrate that they themselves had been subjected to the surveillance, they had been harmed. I think that would probably be the end result of any lawsuit, you know, that arises out of the conduct that's traced in this memo. It's worth stressing there are already pending lawsuits, one by the ACLU and I think one by the Oregon Department of Justice against the Department of Homeland Security, arising out of many of the activities on the ground in Portland. But, you know, I'm always one to think that the courts have something to do. And I think this is actually an area where they have very little to do. I mean, this is ultimately, you know, a question of reining in statutory authorities that are being used in ways that I don't think anyone can reasonably argue Congress ever intended. And reining them in, mind you, for a department that was created, you know, 18 years ago, entirely so that we would be better prepared to face real threats to the homeland. And, you know, that this is what the Department of Homeland Security is more interested in finding out who defaced a federal courthouse in Portland than it is in actually helping to combat the spread of a, you know, deadly and unprecedented public health, you know, virus of coronavirus. Says just about everything I think that there is to say about how the Trump administration structures its priorities and about what kind of faith we should have in that kind of decision making.
Well, I have a feeling this overall conversation is not over, but this particular one is. Benjamin Wittes, Steve Vladek, Kerry Cordero, and Paul Rosenzweig, thanks for joining me. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share and rate the podcast, whatever you can do to help us spread the word about it, especially on an important topic like this. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo Studios is our ever-patient audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.